For the benefit of the talk, you've missed the first minute or two. God is a worker and he made us to work. He made the world. He made us to work in it. Genesis 2, the Lord God took the man, put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. We have moments of that, don't we? There are moments when you've done a good piece of DIY, okay, granted rare in my case, and you think, that's marvellous. You know, I'm really proud of what I've done there. That's even I've been known to find on the rare occasions that I've done ironing. There is a satisfaction that comes from finishing an ironing pile. Yes?
Mm-hmm.
We can have experiences at work that make us think, this isn't bad. Work can be good. And I want to start by saying that all work, but I'm then going to qualify all work is good. All legitimate work is good. There are certain professions that involve cat burglary and doing things horizontal that are probably not good forms of work. Are not good forms of work. But all legitimate work is good. And I think the danger, particularly if we come from middle-class professional sort of environment, is that we can become quite snobbish, and I would say actually pagan, in our view of work, whereby we might say, well, of course, the creative industries and the managerial industries and the healthcare industries, because they're good, aren't they, are good industries, and sort of things that involve you getting your hands dirty and doing something repetitive and menial are bad industries. And that is not God's view. That is not, I think, a biblical Christian view. So, again, it should be obvious. Those of us who are accountants, will the world notice if we stop doing our accounting thing quicker than if the sewage workers stop doing their sewage working thing?
Yeah.
And the reality is, we know he'll be missed quicker. Yep. So all work is good. It's dignified. It comes with responsibility. I want to get say again, all work is good. That's not only paid work. So routinely Rachel is asked, and what do you do? Meaning, sorry, Rachel, my wife. What do you do? And routinely she's asked, and what do you do? To which the answer is, somewhere in between raising children, being an unpaid woman's worker within the village, caring for my parents, etc. None of which is paid for, all of which is work, all of which is good. And actually, she came home from having seen her sisters last week, and she said, I'm rubbish, they run their own businesses, they're great at computers. And I had to just explain to her things that she knows. We'll get there ultimately in the talk. But what is of greater eternal significance, raising five believing children and pastoring women within the village, or running your home, your catering business for frightfully nice people who can afford quite nice food? What is of greater significance? It's because we're made for work that unemployment is, I think, particularly challenging. There is a real sense in which it's an assault on our human dignity, and there is a real sense in which it is wrong, and we need to really take care of those among us who are out of work. This was brought home to me not when I lost my job, but actually I was very humbled. One of the opportunities I had was at my leaving drinks, I said to the guys and women who were there, lots of them wonderfully, I've been cautious about abusing my position of power and telling you about my faith. As of now, I have no power. Please all come and hear me speak as to why belief in Jesus is not delusional. And so 60 of them amazingly came and heard me speak. And the people who were helping me by sort of handing out drinks, manning the door, doing the recording, etc., were guys who were themselves currently out of work, but they were working. And I thought that was, I mean, it was fantastic for me to have their help. And I think a good illustration of, again, not all work is paid work, but that work is good work. Mm. Second important point, God has cursed the world of work. Work, as God originally created it, was good, but we will always be frustrated at work. Caroline, we were chatting earlier. You were telling me about the frustration of your boss. I can identify with that. I could talk for an hour and a half about that. But there is a great danger, I think, especially, again, for those of us from a sort of a middle class, I've got quite an interesting job background, that we buy the lie that we can be fulfilled at work. And you will not be fulfilled at work because the world of work has been cursed, and we will therefore find all forms of work ultimately frustrating. Furthermore, almost all work is ultimately futile. And I'll go on and explain that in a moment. So we know about the consequences of Adam and Eve's rebellion. Cursed is the ground because of you. Through painful toil you will eat food from it all the days of your life. It will produce thorns and thistles for you. You will eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your brow you will eat your food until you return to the ground, since from it you are taken. For dust you are, and to dust you will return. So, work, hard labour, pain, frustration, grim. Don't think it's going to be life-changingly wonderful. I've been on gardening leave for 6 months. There are many things about growing a garden that are wonderfully wonderful. But the flipping weeds keep returning. I mean, that is our experience of gardening, and that is our experience of work, that you do the thing and then you have to do it again, and the ironing pile that I'd got that nanosecond of satisfaction from for completing it endlessly repeats and is endlessly frustrating. That is, and the DIY that I did as a excited 52-year-old looks pretty naff when I'm 53 and it falls off the wall. Frustration. You know, my business, my people, my success, my career, my status, all came to a crashing halt. Ironically, on the very day that Brexit was meant to happen. So 1st of April, April Fool's Day, was meant to be the first business day of life post-Brexit. Well, that didn't happen, but it was Pilxit. I was out on my ear. No more work. And if my status and significance and personal worth was bound up in my wonderful success at work and how wonderfully well I was regarded and all the rest of it, where does that leave me on the 1st of April other than an April Fool? Well, the answer to that is it left me married for 30 years because it was also my wedding anniversary and it was a great day. On the day when I was, not that I knew it, back in February, effectively to receive the bullet in the back of my head from my boss, I didn't know it was going to happen. In my daily Bible reading, by complete chance, this is what I read. So I hated life, because the work that is done under the sun was grievous to me. All of it is meaningless, a chasing after the wind. I hated all the things I had toiled for under the sun, because I must leave them to the one who comes after me. And who knows whether that person will be wise or foolish? Yet they will have control over all the fruit of my toil, unto which I have poured my effort and skill under the sun. This too is meaningless. Ecclesiastes chapter 2, verses 17 to 19. I promise you, I read that on the morning of the 18th of February. And lo, the guy who's taken over is an idiot. Sorry, I was told not to do that. I'm out. I'm as relevant as last week's newspaper. Except I'm not useful for wrapping up fish and chips. So work is ultimately frustrating and pointless. A number of you are medics, just to pop your bubble. I'm sure you don't. But sorry, your job is meaningless too. Because all you are at best doing is extending lives by a few weeks or months or years. And they too will die and they will return to the ground. And you'll have helped them briefly, but sorry. To the ground we shall all return. So why do we work? Well, we work because it's dignified and good. And work is what we're made for, and we are genuinely made to work. And there is honour and dignity in work. But we also do it out of necessity. We do it boldly to feed our faces, so that we can put money on the table. We can't eat money. Can't eat money. So we can put food on the table. But some of us are also in a position to finance gospel ministry, and some of us are in a position to finance a lot of gospel ministry because we've been paid stupid amounts of money. And so some of us are in a position to be, to give a lot more. Generosity isn't about what you give, it's about what you hold back. We're in a position to give. And so boldly, the message for all of us is, we need to work. We might not get paid for it, but we all need to work. Let's then think about how we should work in the world of work. And I want to sort of preamble before we go to Ephesians. No, we'll go to Ephesians chapter 6, which is there towards the back, bottom of the page. And sort of the summary, Christian workers or workers who are Christians, we have a new boss and we have a new motive. Book of Ephesians begins with Paul laying out the great blessings that God has won for us. And at the climactic point of the list of blessings that God has for us is chapter 1, verse 9. God made known to us the mystery of his will according to his good pleasure. What is the mystery of his will? To be put into effect when the times have reached their fulfillment, to bring all things in heaven and on earth together under one head, even Christ. God's big plan is to bring everything under Christ, to unite everything under Christ. And that is the big blessing that he's given to us, is to be part of that plan so that all things come under the rule of Jesus. And what God does in, what Paul does in the letter is he shows us how through Jesus' death and resurrection we are brought to be part of God's greater plan. And I think as we think about work, we need to keep in mind that work is a part of that bigger plan, which is to bring all things under Jesus. And what he does is he uses you and me now as part of that. He's put us sort of in a display cabinet. We are God's display. We're there to display to the non-Christian world so that they can see our lives, and that our lives should then point to that bigger God's plan of bringing everyone under Christ. And so what Paul goes on to explain is that Christ should impact every aspect of our life, whether it's our marriage or how we engage in work. And so if you read chapter 4, verse 1, he says, "As a prisoner for the Lord, then I urge you to live a life worthy of the calling you've received." He says, "No longer live as the Gentiles do, but live a life of love." Chapter 5, "Live as children of the light." Later in chapter 5, "Be very careful how you live." And so then as we approach work, we've got to remember that everyone's watching us, and they're drawing conclusions about the nature of God as they look at you and they look at me. And as they see that we have changed teams, we've moved from the kingdom of not loving God to the kingdom of God and his children. The pathetic example, as a Southampton fan, anybody else share that, say it's sad affliction?
Yes.
I did know that, Stuart.
We're rare.
So, my wife supports Liverpool Football Club. I describe Liverpool as Southampton rejects, because half the Liverpool team, at least, came from the mighty Southampton. Virgil van Dijk. Imagine you're Jurgen Klopp. Virgil van Dijk, for those of you who are not remotely interested in football, is the world's most expensive fullback and arguably the reason why Liverpool won the Champions League last season. In fact, I would say unarguably the reason why they won the Champions League. Used to play for Southampton. Imagine you're Jurgen Klopp and Southampton come to Anfield, where Liverpool play. And Jurgen Klopp, manager of Liverpool, takes Virgil aside and says, "Look, Virgil, remember, you're now playing for us. You no longer play for the Saints. You've changed. You've changed allegiance. You're now playing for the Reds. No longer a Saint. It's a bad direction to go. You don't want to stop being a Saint. You've got to play for us. Don't go kicking the ball behind your own goalkeeper." The same principle, clearly, we need to have a serious integrity at work because we've changed masters. Chapter 6, verse 5. "Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favour when their eye is on you, but as slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart." And so my clear take from that is that I need to work even when the boss isn't watching me, as if he were watching me. Well, no, not as if he were watching me, but knowing that God, the boss, is watching me. So whether he's away or at a conference or just seriously incompetent, I need to be competent. I need to be working in a godly way, doing a serious day's work, whether that's at the lecture theatre or in the operating theatre or in the boardroom or as I empty bins. I think it calls for us to act with integrity towards our colleagues. So one of the principles I had was that I made a point of, as I walked in the office, I would greet the people who everybody else ignores, the security guards. I would make a point of speaking to our reception staff. Actually, they're about the most important people in the office because they're the first people your clients meet. I sought to treat with dignity and respect the least important, and not just those who could help me up the greasy pole. How you engage in office politics. Every office has its politics. If someone's stabbing me in the back, will I get my revenge in first? Clear injunctions from Christ as to how I behave in that context. Will I behave towards others as Jesus would behave towards them? Language, sense of humour needs to reflect Christ's rule in our lives. So the sort of the salacious gossip, etc. One of the things that I had to do quite early on was apologise for messing up, for getting things wrong. People were genuinely astonished when I took people aside and said, look, I'm really sorry, I got that. I treated you wrongly there, or I made the wrong conclusion, or I just handled that situation badly. People had righteous indignation about how I'd performed, but the moment I apologised clearly, that defused the situation. And I think for many people, it was the first time a boss had ever apologised to them. New motives. Do you have end of year appraisals? Do we all hate them? I had 4 months, I start the new job in a week's time, 4 months before I started, the HR director at the new place contacted me to say that he wanted to discuss the annual review process and my views on how it should link to remuneration. I'm thinking, I don't want to talk about that at all. I'm enjoying not working right now. But Paul makes the point that we're to work when the boss isn't watching us, knowing that the boss is watching us. And your boss may be great or gormless. She may be a despot or a complete soft touch. But the appraisal process that we should really care about is the appraisal process from God. What would God have to say about how you're conducting yourself? I sought not to work hard to get a pay rise. I guess I've been fortunate in that I've not had to do much of that. But rather than being valued in our own eyes and in other eyes by promotions and what we're being paid, the assessment that we should really care about is what does God think about who we are in the workplace and what would he have to say to us? The thing I want to finish on and actually spend perhaps a bit more time on is I want to encourage us all to work for things that will last. The danger when we're at work is we get sucked into the work of work. And work, I mean, it's important that we do the work of work, and I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do it. But we've already realised that ultimately most people's jobs are an exercise in futility. Because no matter how wonderfully balanced your accounts are, ultimately it's all going to get burnt up. And no matter how wonderfully precise someone's teeth are, the teeth are going to get burnt up. And the real work that God wants us to be engaged in is that plan of uniting everything under Christ. And that's work that will last. And we know that God sent Jesus in order to draw people to himself, and that he's given us all a privileged part in that. And so my prayer as I go to work each day is that I will have opportunity to point people to Christ. Now, granted, rarely does that happen at 10:30 in the morning in a board meeting. I have yet to be in a board meeting where that happens. In fact, rarely, fairly rarely does that happen between 9 and 5 at work. The opportunities that I've had have much more often, not exclusively, but much more often been in the pub after work or on a business trip or when I'm talking to a colleague about how they're coping at home or things like that. Sometimes it's happened with people where I've explicitly, in a sense, cast a fly and seen how they respond and try and hook the trout by asking them a question about what they believe. So I've had an ongoing conversation with my, well, I'd call him a friend. He calls me a friend, so I can call him a friend. He's a Muslim. He was a project manager who worked on a project that I was the executive sponsor for. Saj and I got on really well. I had mint tea with him in an appropriate location about a month ago, not having worked with him for 5 months. And, you know, it started by me asking him about his life. I knew he was a Muslim, but I wanted to know more about him, and he wanted then to know about me. We're continuing those conversations. Other conversations, though, have come completely out of the blue. So I was at a colleague's leaving drink, and a fairly junior person from the finance department spoke to me, and Maria said, "Simon, you behave differently from everybody else. I know you're a believer. What's it all about?" Now, she's from Russia. I said to Maria, "It seems to me that often people from Russia come from one of two worldviews. Either they've been brought up with an atheistic worldview, and what I'd say to someone from an atheistic worldview is you need to look into the facts about Jesus and investigate for yourself. Or people from Russia come from a worldview that is sort of traditional Russian Orthodox, and what I'd say to people from that background is you need to look into the facts about Jesus Christ and find out about him for yourself." She was willing to read books. I don't know where she is. I've had to leave the firm. But I'm looking for those conversations. And often that means that I need to be willing to actually put in some time with people after work in a way that was hard when we had a young family, because the call to get home to look after the little ones, you know, before we had kids, easy. Now most of my kids, well, the youngest one's 17 and I don't need to change his nappy. But so I've had more conversations at different phases in my life than at others. But I'm looking for those opportunities. It was wonderful to have that opportunity to leave and to use that opportunity to encourage people to come and hear me. And I'm now trying to follow up on some of those people. But I think the big challenge is to operate with integrity so that our words have some integrity. I am not pretending that I'm in any way perfect, because I am absolutely not. And my colleagues know that I'm not. I suppose they arguably know that more than even my wife, because you see more of your colleagues than you do of your spouse. But I want to encourage each of us to think of work as a mission field and a mission opportunity. In the city where I work, it's great because there are lunchtime talks that are there as a real... they're a real help to my ministry of speaking to my colleagues, because I can say, not just here's my view, but come along and hear this talk. But what I find really helpful is that the minister there says that he doesn't have a ministry, he's there to support my ministry. Mm-hmm. And I think as a takeaway, is a really helpful one, I've found really helpful. So daily I'm praying that I would honour Christ by how I operate in the office. And daily I'm praying that I would have opportunities to speak of him, or that people would notice, that I'd be able to point to him. Someone reminded me of this Steve Jobs story, and it's a bit cheesy. He wanted to recruit a guy called John Sculley, is that how you pronounce him? Who was the president of Pepsi, to come and work for him at Apple. And he'd worked on him for a long time and was sort of struggling to close the deal, so to speak. So eventually Jobs issued this challenge to Sculley. He said, quotes, "Do you want to spend the rest of your life selling sugared water? Or do you want a chance to change the world?" And that convinced Sculley to become Apple's chief executive in 1983. Now, ladies and gentlemen, shock, Apple doesn't change the world. In fact, Apple doesn't change one individual eternally. But Christ does. And so, do you want to sell sugared water for the rest of your life? Or should we be ploughing our energy into making a difference for eternity? I start a new job on Tuesday. It's the 1st of October. It's the day that I'm free from M&G, although it's jolly kind of them to keep paying my salary, even this week. And my prayer is that I will have opportunities to find other Christians, to seek to encourage them to live for Christ in the office, that I'd be able, I've already actually been reasonably clear with them, because I had to go in a do a town hall before I joined. I had the opportunity to tell a town hall, chat to the troops. Here's the new boss. He's arriving in a few months' time. I had the opportunity to tell them what I'd been doing with some of my time off. But yeah, I want to go and nail my colours to the mast, praying for opportunities to speak to people in whom God's at work, praying that I'd honour him in the way in which I conduct myself rather than dishonour him. Yeah.
That's timely. We can pray for you as you head off to do that.
That'd be great. I didn't give anyone a chance to ask any questions along the way.
No, that's now. Let's see. I feel like you're senior enough to be nailing your colours to the mast, but for a young person coming in at the bottom of a firm, who if they rock the boat with a word wrongly said, it feels a harder place to be. Not impossible, but harder.
I think it's the other way around.
Go on, tell me.
So what I was going to ask, if you were still the exec sponsor for that chap who you're friends with, would you still have been able to talk about your faith in that kind of way, or did you? And did you have any issues with that as somebody in a position of power over that person? Can you talk to some of those issues?
Yeah. So look, I may have got it wrong. I sought to be very cautious about abusing my position of power. So the conversations I had with Sarge started not by me saying, "I've got some stuff I want you to hear about Jesus." They started by me asking him about him. Yeah. So, you know, tell me about you, Sarge. Tell me about your wife and your children. Tell me about, are you Sunni or Shia? Mm-hmm. "I don't know, Simon," was his answer. "I need to go and find out." That was brilliant. So show an interest. I mean, I'm genuinely interested in him. He then asks me some questions. Well, what's wrong with that? Now, he's delighted to talk about it. It's purely getting to know someone and showing a genuine interest in them. And I think it was entirely natural And in no, I haven't at this point invited him to anything.
Mm-hmm.
When I met him last week, I was praying that it would be appropriate for me to offer him a book. I didn't think on that meeting it was. I've got a couple of books that I've got lined up for him, books that I've read and found genuinely interesting and helpful. Nabil Qureshi, I don't know if you've read him, but Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, No God But One, brilliant books. So that's why at my leaving drinks I said, look, I've sought not to abuse my position of power. You all know I'm a Christian, but I've not rammed it down your throat. But in one sense, it is much easier, I think. Though it's easier for me to, we could be having a conversation about, I don't take work home and I don't work at weekends. Okay, I'm in an industry where that's a bit more easy and I don't work shifts, and I'm not saying you shouldn't work shifts, but I've sought to keep work within bounds because there are more things that are more important to me than just my work. And people could say, well, that's easy for you as a senior person, and the answer is yes, it is easier. But I've wanted to encourage my more junior Christian colleagues to be really out as Christians in the workplace, because I think it's much easier for them to invite people because they haven't got any power to abuse, to invite people to things.
Well, I find that a hard dynamic. It's a line manager in my team. It's probably, they're only to talk directly about Christian things, you say, unless they bring it up or they have some crisis that brings a discussion about what else is important in life outside of work.
But you can still cast flies over people. Mm. What do you think? Why do you think it? What did you do at the weekend? Yeah. There'd be much. Probably your book's got some good lines in, but you can.
Those are conversations we can have. Very rarely will they ask beyond if I say I went to church, and then rarely get to beyond.
Sure. So I'll go months and months and months without a clear Christian opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, there have been some great opportunities with other colleagues, but not necessarily with those who are within my team.
You were, fairly mature. Well, if you've been a Christian at 15, you've been taught and going to good CUs through school, university and camps and stuff. You were arriving, probably quite fired up, to live as a Christian at work. But is there anything 35 years down the track that you'd go, I really would have valued this steer? It sounds like you've given us pretty much the steers that would have been very, and probably were helpful. Is there anything specific?
Well, the thing I'd always say to everyone, whether they're 21 or 53, is start as you mean to go on. Nail your colours to the mast at the earliest opportunity. Seek to be as clear as possible from the outset as to where you're coming from.
Have you been persecuted for being a Christian at work?
There's no question that there are certain people who really dislike me, and I think it's because I'm a Christian rather than because I'm an obnoxious person. I mean, I am an obnoxious person too, but there are definitely people who I think my faith causes significant antipathy. But I think that's fairly, it's not many, and I wouldn't say, life has not been hard for me. As a Christian,
has it come
at
to
work?
A head with a boss who's not a Christian saying, this is the way we do things at this firm, and you've said, I as a Christian can't with a clear conscience?
So I had the same boss for 17 years, which was wonderful. The culture that the newest boss, who's not been in place for long, was inculcating, was a culture that I thought was wrong. And I would say that from a Christian perspective, and I was not supportive of that culture, and I think it's probably a significant factor in him wanting me out.
So would you have resigned, you think? If
I came home at Christmas and said to the family, I've got to get out because this culture is not a culture that I can subscribe to. Amazingly, and without me looking, headhunters started calling me in January. The role that I take up, that I'm taking up next week, is one of those conversations that began in January, and my boss sort of shot me in February, so to speak, and I formally left at the end of March.
How did I juggle priorities? Was the question. Certain things went into my diary and my PA knew. So two things, Wednesday evening Bible study. My PA knows that I have a Wednesday evening Bible study, and therefore, not that I'm a great one for doing evening events full stop, but Wednesday evenings are really strictly forbidden. I mean, occasionally you have to do travel, but you know. And then similarly, I sought to go to Tuesday lunchtime talks at St. Helens Bishopsgate. In practice, I'd probably get 3 out of 4. There would occasionally be meetings that sort of required me to be at them. It would be too difficult to reorganise, but that then meant that nobody else was organising one-on-one meetings with me because I was already booked then, because it was there as a prior diary commitment. When children were young, I had a bigger need to get home to support Rachel and see the children, and thus the amount of time I'd spend at after work, drinks, etc., was significantly less than before children or once children are older. Church commitments. I mean, the reality is that you make time for things that are important. And if ultimately work is always coming top of the what do I do or don't I do, that's telling you that work is what you live for and work is your idol. And so I'm not saying you should do this or you shouldn't do that, but those were some of the, and I'm not saying I got it right, but those were some of the, you know, if I can no longer be on the preaching team because work is too time consuming, what's that telling me? So if you're having that conversation with yourself about what priorities you are or aren't taking up, then that's about helping you being honest with yourself.
And you kept a daily Bible reading routine on the train? What have you done?
I find it much easier when I have routine. So for the last 6 years, I've sought to read the Bible in a year, and commuting on the train is wonderful. People say, how on earth do you commute? The answer is, when else do you get an hour to yourself twice a day to, in my morning commute would be I read the Financial Times, I read the Bible, pray for the day, and I may prepare my board meeting, or read my board papers then. I've learned how to speed read. And coming home is often a combination of read a novel, 10 minutes sleep works wonders, quite a lot of Bible studies get prepped on the train, quite a lot of sermon prep happens on the train. So commuting actually for me has been brilliant. That's why driving for me would be much harder, because that's some time that you can't.
Yeah, you can.
You can listen to good stuff.
Yeah.
Well, okay. Yeah, you can.
But I listen to sermons from...
You can write texts or something.
No, you mustn't do that. And the really frustrating thing was that Jen Wilkins book. It just said, scriptures to reflect on. 1 Timothy 3. I'm like, no, read it to me. I can't stop and read this. I'm driving, Jen. But in general, it makes a massive difference.
Pray the paper in the car.
Yeah.
You can pray out loud in the car because no one can hear you. Yeah.
So, can you give us some advice on those situations where you're disagreeing with what your boss is saying, or what your company's policy is, or what your colleague is saying, or even someone under you is saying? How do you go about making that your mind up as to, you know, when do I make a stand here? When does it become important enough to, I really do need to say something here? Or, you know, what are the sort of different levels of which one acts or just keeps one's, bites one's tongue?
I mean, if you're asked to do something that's illegal,
yes,
that's
quite clear.
Clear doesn't mean it's easy.
No.
I hope and pray most of us aren't in that situation very often.
It's more the balance between submitting to your boss because they are your boss, and yet they're asking you to do something which isn't illegal, isn't particularly unethical, but you just think is stupid. Or a bit inconsiderate, or not the right way.
Could be done better.
Or
I mean, part of that is then about knowing your boss and knowing how to engage with them. So, is it best to sort of go in all guns blazing? Often not. Often best to try and come back to that issue later. Often drip it in. Often sort of go a roundabout route. How bad is it? How much of a fuss do I want to make about it? Is it something that I think is sort of, okay, it's not a great decision, it's not one I'd have made, but hey ho, let's get on with it? Or is it sort of poisoning the well of the whole ethos and culture? I mean, I was running a division and then two divisions. And I thought the most significant, the brilliant thing about that is you're in a position to influence the culture. And I went in thinking, okay, there's some things that need changing here. But towards the end, my colleagues were very clear about the culture that there was, what they and they valued it, massively valued it. Mm-hmm. So it then becomes a, you know, so you start by thinking, I want to change this. You then talk about it. You then tell people what they're doing it. You then get everybody else to buy into it. If it's something that's sort of in a sense undercutting that from underneath, and I fought it for a year and a half, that's sort of when I got to the point of I can't really work here anymore. Now, it got to me first. I don't really know, Stuart, the answer.
Why do you think in Ephesians 6 verse 5 it says, slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear? Is it that fearing them? Is that fearing God?
I struggled latterly to respect my boss. But I sought to respect my boss. And if I had a disagreement, best that that disagreement happens privately. And best that that disagreement happens calmly and appropriately. But my boss is my boss. I mean, I'm not owned by my boss, which sort of a slave sort of was back then. They weren't manacled and all the rest of it. But is my boss likely to listen to me if I'm insolent or if I'm respectful? With fear, well, is that part of the earthly authorities over which God has placed above me, and there's a real sense in which we're called to submit to the authorities and to behave towards them with respect and with fear, because they wield the sword. So there's a...
A due reverence for the fact that you are not the boss they are. It could just be that's an appropriate underneath the bracket of fear. You can get on with your job respectfully, but have no sense that actually really care or they really matter. Or I think the fear has to do with them being in charge and you not being, and acknowledging that.
Is the fear in this instance the same as fear of the law?
Well, I would say not, because fear of the Lord trumps everything.
No, in terms of meaning.
Do
they fear and wonder as opposed to fear and terror?
Yeah.
I think it's the latter. The commentary is fairly like trembling and fearful, frightful kind of understanding of who your masters are. Fear in terms of being motivated to please them as to please God. Mm.
As you would have advised.
Very different types of fear, isn't it? So I'm afraid of the road, quite rightly. Because if I wander around the road, I'll get run over and die. So will my kids, hence why I shout at them and grab them and make the road a big deal. It's right to be afraid of things, isn't it? Mm. I can have a respect for the road, the fear of it is a different thing.
Mm.
So I have a meeting with the owner of our company. Am I trembling of fear? No, I'm not. But do I prepare very well? Yeah, I do. Because I fear him.
The boss fired me. And actually, given I profoundly disagreed with him and his ethos, he was right to.
There's a difference as well, isn't there, between respecting someone for their position and their views and actions. So I think you can still respect them in their position over you, but you might actually have no respect whatsoever for what they're doing. But I think that's okay, isn't it?
Unless the latter causes me then to treat them with contempt.
Yes.
I think in reality it gets very messy. And that's sort of part of what we're talking about, isn't it? I think that's part of what I found difficult recently, is that the straightforward stuff, the them telling you to do something either illegal or against the Ten Commandments, to lie on paper, or is really straight. It's really easy. It's when they then say, "Oh, but Caroline, what you need to understand is that if we don't do this, then it means that this really bad thing happens, and we're really stuck, and we're."
Mm-hmm.
It's the mess that and the sort of complexity. But I think it probably isn't as complicated, really. But it's that kind of thing that I think is really difficult.
Is it okay to go ahead and do something, but make it clear in a respectful way that you don't actually think you should be doing it? So you may say, well, I'll do it, but for reasons I outlined, I do not think this is the right way forward. But I don't think, you know.
I suppose it depends what it is, doesn't it?
You know, a massive thing, but I just want to. I want it admitted that I don't support this, or whatever. I mean, I've been in partners' meetings where I've said, I'm happy to proceed on the will of the partnership because it's a partnership decision, but I'd like it admitted that I voted against this. And that's generally been accepted as being okay.
Yeah.
So in one sense, I'm showing respect. This is a partnership decision. I'm going with the decision. But I'm not willing to be kind of labelled.
To pretend that you're happy with it.
Yeah, because I wasn't. But it wasn't an issue where I'm saying, okay, that's it, guys, I'm off. Because it wasn't that bad.
It's making that decision when it's that bad, I think.
Yeah. I've only once had to disagree with my boss, again, privately in a meeting, say, I don't think this is the right reason. way to go about this. But and then after a few minutes of consideration, he basically said, well, it has to be this way. Uh-huh. And it wasn't over an ethical thing, it was just
judgment.
Judgment, and he said it has to go this way.
Well, that, he's the boss.
And he, it took me probably a week to come to terms with it. But in the meeting, I had to say, well, you're the boss, that's the way we'll do it.